That's Ben Webster on tenor sax, with Thad Jones on cornet, Sam Jones on bass, Philly Joe Jones. It was a Jones kind of a day. Philly Joe Jones on the drums, and a young Joe Zawinul on piano with Soulmates. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, August the 28th, and on this day, this is the actual 50th anniversary day of the March on Washington, the nation is brought a hair's breadth away from war against Syria. The Democratic-dominated 50th anniversary March on Washington commemoration has not stifled the Republicans' desire to be known to African Americans as the Party of Freedom. We will hear about that and the commitment of the Republicans telling their side of the story of commitment in the second half of our program. But first, we talk about education apartheid in America. When newly elected Governor George Wallace in 1963 defied the U.S. Supreme Court's Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 and refused to desegregate Alabama's public schools, his vow of segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever, which he recanted decades later, was nonetheless prophetic. 50 years after the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, including the right to equal education, the nation's public schools remain bastions of apartheid, says Richard Rothstein, a research associate of the Economic Policy Institute and a senior fellow of the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Law and Social Policy at the University of California School of Law. He is the author of Grading Education, Getting Accountability Right, Class in Schools, Using Social, Economic, and Educational Reform to Close the Black-White Achievement Gap, The Way We Were, Myths and Realities of America's Student Achievement, and The Charter School Dust-Up, Examining the Evidence on Enrollment and Achievement. And lastly, I would mention, all else equal, are public and private schools different? And we welcome you, Richard Rothstein, to Lead Stories today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, suppose we start with that very statement, the declarative statement that the education gap today is a mind-boggling story that began decades ago.
Well, that's true. We've known that the achievement of black and white children, on average, are quite different for at least 50 years. And we've also known that the primary reason for this difference in achievement is not the quality of schools they attend, but the differences in the social and economic circumstances of their families, which bring them to school in very different conditions of readiness to learn. So the achievement gap that we hear about so much is not primarily the result of differences in school quality, but it's a consequence of the social and economic inequality between black and white populations in this country.
Why does this status remain the same, in your view?
Well, the status remains the same because we have abandoned narrowing inequality and integration as goals, and instead are trying to blame schools for the low achievement, average achievement of African-American children, and think somehow we can raise that achievement without dealing with the underlying cause, which is their segregation and their low social and economic status.
I want to ask perhaps a controversial question, which is, I have a friend who was born and raised in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and she's a contemporary of mine, meaning we're roughly the same age. We're 22. No matter what people say, I always say I'm 22. But that aside, in Muskogee, the children of her town, it was an all-African-American town where she lived, and the children were consigned to manual training high school. And I was helping her with a speech, is how I got to know this. And I thought she said, I went to Emmanuel Training High School. And I said, that's an odd name, but last name Training. She says, no, Manual Training High School. And I said, well, what is that? And it was then that I learned that in Muskogee, as it was the case in many, many other parts of the United States, the black children were taught basically in these schools that prepared them literally for manual labor. The girls learned how to make the bed properly. Guys learned wonderful things like how to scientifically dig a ditch and other things like that. But the story she told was that in her classroom and in her town, the parents and the teachers essentially waged a very quiet revolution so that none of the children actually succumbed to the intended outcome for them. In other words, in all black districts, is it understood that, for example, that it automatically consigns children to a poor education? And therefore, what would have been the difference from Muskogee's school to the typical public school today with an all-black student population?
Well, I think the description of the school in Muskogee that you just gave is not typical of most schools that are serving largely African-American populations today. They are making futile attempts to provide academic instruction to children, but without dealing with the conditions in these children's lives that bring them to school less ready on average to take advantage of that academic instruction than children from more privileged backgrounds, their efforts come to naught. We've engaged in some 30 years now of school reform efforts, none of which have succeeded, each of which becomes more intense and more condemning of existing public schools, of teachers' unions, and they don't succeed. And the reason they don't succeed is when children come to school in poor health, when they come to school from families that are poorly educated themselves, and so the children are not read to very much, when children are in homes that are unstable and they're moving around a lot so that they're going from classroom to classroom and school to school, when they're highly stressed from walking to school through neighborhoods that are violent and crime-ridden. When children come to school with all those conditions, it is irrational to think that if you give them a good academic education, they're going to achieve at the same average levels that children who come to school with none of those disadvantages have. And so the problem with our schools today is not the Muskogee-type situation, which used to be the norm for black children but is no longer. The problem with our schools today is that we're attempting to solve in schools problems that can't be solved in schools. They have to be solved in the society outside schools.
Well, in a chicken and egg situation, do we have such a thing as a priority? First you do this and then you do that? Or is it a matter of tackling both issues at the same time? Isn't there a mandate essentially to do both things at the same time?
Well, We certainly should do both things at the same time. I'm not suggesting that schools can't be improved, and we should try to improve schools at the same time that we narrow inequality. But our policy priorities today are not to do both. Our policy priority is to focus almost exclusively on schools and not to do anything about their segregation, which is, of course, a function of the fact that the neighborhoods they live in are segregated, and we've had no policy initiatives to speak of that are more than just token to desegregate the residential areas of metropolitan populations, residential areas and metropolitan areas today. We're not doing, as you well know, very much to deal with the housing crisis that African-American families face. We're not doing very much to deal with the unemployment and the economic inequality that these families face. If we dealt with those things, we would do a lot more to raise the achievement of, on average, of African-American children than by trying to test them more or hold their teachers accountable for their achievement and so forth. So we're not trying to do both. We should do both, but all of our policy effort today, virtually all of our policy effort today, is to try to solve the problems of inequality in American society by reforming schools. It's a fruitless endeavor. It hasn't worked for the last 20 or 30 years, and there's no reason to think it's going to work from this point forward.
All right. You have studied this issue for quite some time. What would you suggest as a comprehensive approach to dealing with both situations? The fact that schools are being attended by children who are living in a kind of isolation, an isolated community, isolated by with trenchant poverty, systemic poverty. How does America cope with this particular? What is the answer is what I'm asking.
Well, there are many answers, and they're all quite practical, but as I indicated before, they're not on the political agenda today. So they may seem unrealistic when I describe them. At one time, they were quite actively debated, and they are quite practical. For example, most of our suburbs today, our all-white suburbs today, have zoning ordinances which prevent the construction of housing for low- and moderate-income families. This is one thing that locks low-income African-American children and their families in urban ghettos. Repealing those exclusionary zoning ordinances, that is, ordinances that require every building in a town or most buildings in a town to be on one-acre lots or to have a minimum of so many square feet that make it impossible to build multi-unit housing and low- and moderate-income housing in those communities. Another practical solution would be to, we now provide vouchers to families who are working families for rent, but when their incomes are not sufficient to rent market rate apartments in their communities, we provide vouchers that make up the difference roughly between a third of their income, which is what the normal rents would be, and their actual earnings. But we don't require that the landlords in predominantly white neighborhoods accept those vouchers. So the vouchers perpetuate ghetto conditions rather than offset them. So one thing we could do is to require landlords to accept these housing vouchers, even in white middle-class neighborhoods. That's another very practical thing we could do. We could provide incentives in urban areas for example, for primary care physicians to locate in those areas so that even with insurance, children in low-income communities are not dependent on hospital emergency rooms and clinics. That would be another very practical thing that we could do. So there are many ways of addressing early childhood. Let me just say another very important thing to do would be provision of high-quality early childhood programs to children who are from low-income families. Right now, most of them are in low-quality daycare centers parked in front of television sets. That's not the kind of activity that prepares them to succeed in school. And if children, and this can be said of all of the examples I've just used, if children are parked in front of television sets all day, no matter how much you test them once they get to school, they're not going to achieve at the same level on average as children who are engaged in high-quality play activities supervised by professionals with a high level of intellectual content and language that adults use to them. Those are the differences that translate into differences in school achievement, and those are the things that we should be primarily addressing. And not, as I say, trying to test children more or hold their teachers accountable for achieving things that can't be achieved.
Well, you said in a very extraordinary article, that an extensive article that I've read of yours, that the achievement gap, the test scores have become the new civil rights struggle. And basically the measurement of achievement is test scores. But how do you assess, in the years that this particular approach has not been taken, how do we calculate the cumulative damage and loss in terms of human capital in the African-American community?
Well, you can see it in the differences in employment rates. You can see it in the differences in the accumulation of wealth. You can see it in differences in income for employed families. All of these are the results of the fact that we have not integrated our society or done the things that are necessary to prepare disadvantaged children, particularly African-American children, to come to school as ready to learn as middle-class white children are. When I said that the civil rights, that test scores have become the civil rights cause of our generation, I was not saying that's my view. I'm saying that is what the school, so-called school reformers, are saying, and it's a way they have of ignoring whether this is the true civil rights issue, which is the ongoing and even increasing a segregation of low-income African-American children in low-income African-American schools, and ignoring the imperative to desegregate not only the schools, but the residential areas that these schools are located in. That is, in my view, the true civil rights issue of our generation. And those who say that raising test scores is the civil rights issue are obscuring and denying reality.
Have you put forward these proposals of yours before the Department of Education for consideration?
Well, I'm certain that officials of the Department of Education are aware of not just my views, but those of most serious scholars of the social and economic causes of academic achievement. Department of Education officials are certainly aware of it. They repeat it, indeed, but then their policies proceed to ignore it. So it's not a question of them not knowing what the research shows. It's a question of it being too convenient for them to ignore it, because it's much easier to blame teachers than to do the hard work of erasing inequality.
Is this something that can be fought legally as a class action suit?
Well, I don't think that this is a ripe for legal consideration. Certainly in the present Supreme Court, it wouldn't get anywhere anyway. What first has to happen is that we need to reawaken informed opinion about the extent to which we have segregated the society as a matter of purposeful public policy. This is not an accident. The whole notion of de facto segregation is something of a myth. It's all been created by public policy. And most informed people, even people who consider themselves relatively liberal, have forgotten the history about how this was done by state, federal, and local governments. So it seems to me the first step needs to be the re-education of informed opinion, so so that we come to a broader understanding of what needs to be done. Until there is a broad public support for policies of integration and policies of narrowing economic and social inequality, it's foolish to think that a lawsuit can accomplish what we can't accomplish politically.
Would this be something that you may want to convene, say, the various legislative caucuses, the African American Legislative Caucus and the Hispanic Caucus and the Asian Caucus, and basically present this as a form of a briefing for them so that they know what their options are when they get into Congress when they return?
Well, that would certainly be useful, but I think that African American Congress people are the ones who least need this reeducation. Certainly it would be useful to enlist them in more aggressive promotion of these ideas, but it's the broader population that has forgotten our history. It's forgotten how the federal government, for example, required that the suburbs that were developed in this country in the 1950s and 1960s and that created the metropolitan landscape that we're familiar with today, the federal government required explicitly that they be exclusively white. Few people remember that history. And until they do remember it, it's going to be very hard to awaken in them the sense of obligation to undo these policies and their effects.
I want to talk about the nuts and bolts numbers that you have presented in your analysis. Could you talk about some of the significant numbers that you have come up with?
Well, one of the things that I discuss in this paper, I think you're referring to the one that was the report that was issued yesterday, is that despite everything I've just said, the achievement of African American children has increased pretty phenomenally in the last generation. In fact, the achievement, for example, of African American fourth graders in math is now higher than that of white fourth graders only 20 years ago. But the achievement gap hasn't budged because as the social conditions and the school quality has changed to permit that kind of increase in achievement, white students have improved as well. So the achievement gap remains basically the same. There are a number of factors that have contributed to this, and I don't think anybody really knows to what extent each of them is responsible. Certainly it could be that instruction has improved. It's also the case that, for example, black families are now smaller. There are fewer children per family than they were 30, 40 years ago, and that means that children get more individual attention, and that's one of the things that gets them ready for school. Mothers in African-American families, as well as in white families, now have more education than they had 20 and 30 years ago. So even though the differences in the educational attainment of blacks and whites remain, those differences are at a higher level, and that supports a higher level of achievement for all. So in all of these kinds of changes in social conditions, it's very hard to improve social conditions without explicit policy directed at it that improves that of African Americans directly. We have a society which is changing in many ways, for example, the reduction in sizes of families, and that affects everybody. And if everybody improves in that way, then the achievement gap remains, although at a higher level.
So emphasize more the social underpinnings of how children live more than the business of the test scores is what you're saying, and we would see greater equality and, in fact, a greater level of educational attainment among this particular group that has been disfranchised for so long.
That's correct. You cannot address the test scores directly. The test scores reflect the underlying economic and social inequalities of the children, and unless you address the segregation and the inequality that these children experience, you're not going to see improvement reflected in higher achievement to any great extent, to some extent you may. I'm not saying that schools can't be improved a great deal, but by trying to improve only schools without dealing with the background characteristics the children come to school with, not much is going to be accomplished.
I want to ask one question before we wrap up. This is an administration that has closed more public schools than any other administration in the history of the United States. Is that something that bothers you?
Yes, it bothers me a great deal because the basis for closing them is flawed. It's a reflection of the fact that they believe they can solve the social problems of this country by attacking the quality of public education, by creating charter schools, for example, which the research shows don't perform at any higher level than the regular public schools, but it's a quasi-privatization that results in the closing of neighborhood schools on which people depend. And this is all a reflection of the fact that they think, this administration thinks, as well as the previous administration, in this respect it's no different, the two administrations are no different, they think that somehow you can ignore the social and economic underpinnings of academic achievement and try to attack the country, the nation's social problems and economic problems by school reform. It can't be done. And when it fails, instead of reconsidering the approach, they blame the schools for the fact that they cannot undo all the inequalities that are brought to them.
Well, Professor Rothstein, I want to thank you for getting us started on this discussion. I was very impressed with the report. It is thorough, and I'm going to try and see if I can put it up on the website so people can check in and get the links to it to read for themselves your findings, which are quite considerable. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Well, we'll take this break. We'll talk about some really good programs right here at PRN.FM, and then we'll come back to the second part of our discussion right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. We just had quite an eye-opener from Professor Richard Rothstein of the University of California School of Law, and who has been writing specifically on educational issues for quite some time, talking about the fact, and it's quite sobering, that the public school system is as segregated today as it was, if not more so, as it was 50 years ago. And the underlying causes, equally significantly, the underlying causes remain exactly the same. You wouldn't know that from all of the hoopla occurring in Washington, D.C., on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. By the way, the president is supposed to make a speech today, deliver a speech today at 2:45 p.m., along with President Bill Clinton and President Jimmy Carter. And, you know, today being the actual date of the March on Washington, the 50th year. Now, you would notice, of course, that the Democrats had taken just basically, they just gobbled up everything, and you'd never know. You'd think that there was just one party or one group of people interested in the accomplishments of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. But there was a Republican event. It was not really widely known. It was not widely covered at all. But the Republican National Committee had a luncheon on Monday, and what they decided to do was to recommit themselves to the notion that the Republican Party was the party of freedom, and somewhere along the route it had lost its grip on the constituency that it initially had attracted, meaning the African-American community. At this luncheon, Representative James Sensenbrenner, one of the leading voices behind the Voting Rights Act, committed himself to restoring the provisions struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. Representative Sensenbrenner is from the 5th District in Wisconsin, and he made it clear that that was his number one priority when they get back after this recess. But here is the Republican National Committee chairman who is going to be telling us about the Republican Party's commitment to racial equality and its commitment to reaching out to the African-American community. Reince Priebus, in a very short speech, and we'll come back and discuss that right after we hear this little bit from him.
And what a great job that she's done. I think Jim Sensenbrenner just made some news, so that's good job, Jim. You know what? It's always you've got to appreciate the Wisconsin cheesehead leadership. I mean, we've got Jim has been a leader in our state when I was a young guy in Wisconsin. You know, Jim Sensenbrenner, he ran the show. I mean, he was the leader of everything that we did. And then Tommy Thompson came around, and he was a pioneer. And obviously now with Scott Walker, Paul Ryan, Jim Sensenbrenner, Ron Johnson, it's a pretty incredible place. And I'm just grateful for everything that Jim has done. And I know in his heart that what you heard him say, it's really at his core of the things that he believes has done. And I know in his heart that what you heard him say, it's really at his core of the things that he believes. You know, as chairman of the RNC, I wanted to take this opportunity that we had together to commemorate this historic week here in history. And I want to keep my remarks brief, and everyone had said so much, and I'm grateful for everybody here. But if you just look around this room, and just think about what this means for our party, what lessons we can learn, what I can learn as chairman of the party. You know, you can't make the sale if you don't show up and ask for the order, right? And this is a good example of something that a few weeks ago said, you know, we need to be a part of this. We need to commemorate this historic day. Like, well, you know, how many people are going to come? It's that we're in recess and, you know, I don't know, the RNC sending out an invite. And look around. I mean, this is just a complete and total blessing to our party. And I want to tell you, I know that in this room, it's not 100% Republican. I get that. I also know that a few Democrats came up to me and said, you know what? We're supporting this because if the Republican Party is not going to fight like crazy for every single vote in this country, is not going to fight like crazy for the African American vote, then guess what? The other side just takes it for granted. We need both parties fighting for every vote in this country. And Bob Brown has become a mentor to me. And you think about Bob's life, that he sat down at the table with Dr. King. You worked with a president on equality. You visited Nelson Mandela in prison. And we just all want to keep learning from you. We want to grow and learn those lessons. Bob Woodson, you've dedicated your life to building communities, transforming lives, schools, neighborhoods. You're a blessing to so many people. I know you've become a huge blessing to Paul Ryan. And he talks about you everywhere he goes now. And so I thank you for that. Speaker Shannon, I mean, TW, because we're not allowed to call you a speaker anymore. But you can see why we've labeled him as a rising star of this party. It's the future of the Republican Party. And T.W. Shannon. There's members of our committee here, Amata Radawagan, Ada Fisher, Pat Mullins, I'm sure a few more, Jill Holman, others. And we're thankful to you, Jimmy Kemp. Thank you for carrying on the vision of your beloved father, that the American dream should be a reach for all Americans. And it's wonderful to have representatives of the civil rights community, Hillary Shelton from the NAACP, Mayor Muriel from the Urban League, the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, and so many other organizations. At our core, we're fighting in our own ways for a better country. It's so good that we can come together like this. And it's something that, quite frankly, we don't do enough. But we're going to start doing more of it. And I think today is a good lesson of what it means when you decide, you know what, we're going to do it anyway. We're going to put out an invitation. And we've just been overwhelmed today in this afternoon. Now, I know today is not about partisan politics. But I do want to take the chance that we have here to share just a few thoughts about what an anniversary like this means to us as a party, today and in the future. When Dr. King spoke to the crowd not far from here, he said, 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. So 50 years later, as we look back, this commemoration isn't just about the past. If 1963 was a beginning, if the March for Jobs and Freedom was the first step, where do we stand 50 years down the road? Where do we stand a half a century along the journey? Certainly, America has come a long way. On Wednesday, 50 years to the day, after Dr. King spoke on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, America's first black president will address the crowd that gathers. And all Americans understand and recognize that incredible significance. But still, as many before me said, there's so much more work to do. Marchers came to Washington in 1963 to claim their right to the American dream. For those of us in politics or public life today, we can't rest until that dream is in reach for every American. So an anniversary like this isn't just a call to remembrance, it's a call to action. As Americans, what can we do for the cause of justice and opportunity, for the marchers' cause of jobs and freedom? We've got to keep working until every American has a fair shot, until jobs are plentiful and communities are thriving. That means helping black and minority-owned businesses grow. That means ensuring HBCUs weather these difficult economic times. And it means fixing our schools. It means fixing our schools. Every child in America deserves a quality education. The chance to attend a good school is a chance to build a better life. A child's education shouldn't be determined by their zip code. No child should be stuck in a failing school. It's not fair. When children are stuck in failing schools, America is failing its children. We have to fight for better schools for all kids because it's nothing less than a civil rights issue. Education is essential to equal opportunity, and opportunity is essential to the American dream. As Republicans, I think this is just one area where we can lead. Now, as many of you know, I was raised in Kenosha, Wisconsin, not far from Ripon, Wisconsin, where the Republican Party was born in 1854. If you ever wonder where a guy like this gets a name like Reince Priebus, let me tell you. I'm what happens when a Greek and a German get married, okay? I mean, My kids are named Jack and Grace, though, so we went the opposite direction of my parents. So I say, you know, some family traditions are worth putting an end to. So Reince is one of them. But my mom was born in Khartoum, Sudan. And my dad was in the army in Ethiopia. And they moved back, where my dad's family grew up, eventually back to Wisconsin. And I got involved as a little kid in politics, and I was always interested in my grandfather in Greece, who loved politics, and he'd come here and just love this country. And he wasn't from here, but he loved every little thing about it. And it just turned out that I was in the state that the Republican Party was born in. And our party's beginning was born around issues of civil rights and equal opportunity. Our party has a rich, proud history of equality, freedom, opportunity. But we don't tell our story anymore. We've lost the history of this party because we don't tell it. But we're going to. And it's about time we do. But I also know that past accomplishments don't address the issues of the day. I get it. And building a better future is up to us. We have an opportunity here that God gave us. None of us are here by accident. I'm not here standing before you by accident. You didn't come here by accident. We've got a lot of work to do. I want to make you proud of this party. And it's going to take a lot of work. So when we're talking about building a Republican Party like we've never done before, that's exactly what we're doing. I'm not interested in, you know, a story here or there by hiring a couple people down the hallway and calling it outreach. That's not going to do it. What we're talking about is reaching out from every corner of this country, in communities, with community leaders from those communities, influencing the communities and telling our story. We're not going to carpet the world in 3 or 4 months. But I think if we work really, really hard and we start telling our story again, that we can do better. And I know that we can do better. And that's the vision that we have. We should draw inspiration from the words of Dr. King that echoed across the National Mall and across this country in 1963. Words that called us to remember the basic promise of America's founding, that God created us all equal, and all of us deserve an equal chance at making it in this great country. When Dr. King spoke at the march, he spoke of standing in the symbolic shadow of the great emancipator. Today, we stand in the symbolic shadow of the great civil rights leader. And we recommit ourselves to his cause for a better America, to the dream he spoke of when he quoted Isaiah chapter 40 and imagined a day that every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain made low, the rough places made plain, and the crooked places made straight. May God bless the legacy of Dr. King and the March on Washington, and may God guide us in the continued pursuit of what is just and right. Thank you, and God bless you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And it was important to hear that. Why? Because, number one, we're not hearing anything other than the Democrats who have just basically just taken this event as the opportunity to shore up their political currency and to basically, by hogging 100% of the attention, they shut out the possible competition. But it was important to hear it also because you understand clearly that politics is about contact. And the African-American community, Latino community also, these two communities that historically had been marginalized, even by the Democratic Party, we now see that both parties value these votes because it is simply a matter of maintaining their power. But what was significant about Reince Priebus's short speech there was that the Republican Party, and we know we have an image of the Republican Party, which I think is accurate, which is the party associated most often with the suffering of the people of the United States who are at the bottom rungs of the ladder, a kind of conservative extremism in some cases. But you see a coming to terms with reality, a consciousness that the party as currently constituted simply cannot thrive. It will not exist. So they either shift their focus and amend and tweak their whole outlook, or they will just die. The party will be completely irrelevant, especially with the larger demographic shifts that is occurring right now in the United States. The third reason that I wanted to share that with you is that you hear a consciousness that isn't readily expressed by third parties. If only third parties would be as passionate and as conscious and conscientious about reaching out to constituencies that they themselves have marginalized, it would be a great idea. But we see them only at election time, which mimics the pattern of the major established parties. The Democrats and Republicans come around election time. This Republican Party chairman is saying, we're going to break that habit. We are going to be very aggressive about reaching out. And whether we win somebody's approval or we don't, the fact is we are obligated to tell our story. We are obligated, as he says, you can't close the sale unless you basically make the sale. You have to be in it to win it. You've got to be up close and personal with a constituency in order to persuade it as to why it is you are a logical choice, or to simply place yourself within the realm of choice. So it is for these particular reasons that I wanted to share this particular speech with you. It was not covered by the press. I don't know why. It was a very significant event in my view. The Republican National Committee holds a luncheon, and very little coverage. I haven't seen it anywhere. But that statement was very significant. And when Priebus announced, Jim just made some news here, I think what he meant, he was referring to, again, Representative James Sensenbrenner, saying loudly and clearly that he intends to restore the provisions of the Voting Rights Act that were basically struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. That's very significant. It should have made news, but it didn't for some reason. So all around, some really important lessons in this very short speech. We have a young leader of the Republican Party, a conservative party, speaking very openly about the failings of the party. The party has failed to tap into an available pool of supporters. It has failed to make the sale. And therefore, it is committed to making a strong effort to maintain contact in a community that has gone untouched by this party for a long time. I hope the Green Party is listening. I hope the other parties are listening that say that the African American and Latino communities have a vested interest in supporting them. I hope they become as aggressive about telling their stories as well in these communities and reaching out to these communities to make the sale. Tell us why you are compatible with the hopes and dreams and aspirations of these disfranchised communities. And don't sit there and assume that simply because you declare yourself as progressive or you declare yourself as a viable alternative that people just ought to come to you. No, your job is to make the sale. So get on with it already. Get a program going. Let's see you expressing concern about the issues that affect people. We hear the Republican Party saying education is a huge commitment. Now, listen, I'm not pro-Republican Party. I'm saying that it is important to listen to what these people are saying, even if it doesn't transpire in Congress, even if there's no reflection in Congress of the high ideals that Reince Priebus expressed. The fact is that he is publicly articulating a commitment to something, which is a way of saying you can hold them responsible. And it is a dramatic expression that differs from the way the Republican Party has conducted itself, aloof, separate and apart, you know, a kind of elitism within the party. They're saying, no, we have to change our ways. We've got to reach out. And you have to make note of that. It's a very significant development. So thank you for that. I wanted you to also get ready for tomorrow, because we will be closing out today ahead of the president's speech. And so, of course, you know what we'll be talking about tomorrow. Yes, we'll be talking about the president and his speech. You can bet that. So, in any event, thank you so much for joining me today, and hopefully you learned something or began to appreciate something about how, you know, people see themselves. The party sees itself one way, but it's interesting to hear how they see themselves as opposed to how we see them. But nonetheless, a very significant development, a very significant statement yesterday from the Republican National Committee chairman about what the party aims to do this year in order to make it more user-friendly, more approachable by constituencies that have been pretty much written off by this party. And the fact that they are committed to reaching out. The Democrats, you don't hear this stuff from the Democrats. The Democrats just say, well, we got them. We don't have to get too exercised about it. We have their vote. There's no place they could go. So it's no big deal. We don't have to reach and preach to them. But that's significant. So thank you again for joining me today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You want to stay tuned for that. Thanks. Bye-bye.